If you want something in life, you just tell yourself, oh, it'd be good, I can do this. And then you do. No, wait, that doesn't work. I've tried that lots. I still haven't won a gold medal in the Olympics for 100 metres. So there might be something more that you have to do. I wonder what that is. Don't know. Dr. Kerry Spackman knows. He's lolling around our palatial Sydney studios. He's a neuroscientist, which I'm not 100% sure what that is. And he's also an author. The Winner's Bible, Rewire Your Brain for Permanent Change. Oh, yeah. Kerry, hello.
Nice to be here. Hi, Richard.
Kerry, first things first, what's a neuroscientist?
A neuroscientist is a person who understands or researches how the brain actually works. And the interesting thing is it doesn't work how most people think it does.
In what way does it not work how people think it does?
Well, I think most people think the human brain is just like one big computer and there's one of us in there and we just have one big computer program, and if we want to change ourselves, we just somehow reprogram that one thought and we're all fixed. But it doesn't work that way because the brain is actually made up of lots of different modules. And these modules all have their own little agenda, their own little personalities. So there's lots of little Richards running around in there.
Are they all little achievers, or are some of them internal saboteurs, those Richards?
Well, that's the interesting part. Some of them are sort of designed or have evolved from millions of years ago or hundreds of thousands of years ago to help you survive in the jungle when tigers were creeping up behind you. And they might have been pretty good for that sort of stuff, but they may not be optimal for modern society. And so sometimes they make you do things that you don't want to do. So you had your previous talker talking about her love of chocolate. Now, I don't know what she was like. She may have been a super fantastically fit lady and a piece of chocolate wasn't going to hurt her. But there may be some people who know they shouldn't eat chocolate. That's a logical, rational thing they know about. It's a sort of a rule. If they want to lose weight, don't eat chocolate. But they may want to eat the chocolate all the time. And therein you have two little people having opposite directions. And that's often a battle with people. And that's often why self-help books don't work, because they try and fix all that rational, logical stuff and don't actually get to the bottom of it all.
In your book, you differentiate between rules and tools. In the sense of your book, what are tools?
Well, if I just say, for example, what a rule is, and then I'll give you the contrast. So if we want to win Wimbledon, we may say, let's have seven rules to beat Roger Federer. One rule might be, hit the ball where Federer can't get it.
Good rule.
Going to work every time.
Every
time.
If you
hit it where you can't get it, you're going to win Wimbledon. Okay, but how do you do that? Ah. The only way you can do that is to have a set of tools up your sleeve. You've got to have a good backhand, a good forehand, and so on, and you use those to get ahead. And so it's the same with a human being trying to change your life. What you've got to do, first of all, is almost like do an MRI of your brain, of your soul, who you really are. So everybody is an individual person. And so you've got to understand exactly what goes on inside you, and then you pick the tool to adjust what's going on with you.
Is it a depressingly complex way to do this, though? I've got to get the sheets, I've got to write down, I've got to make my own winner's Bible with a photo of me on the cover. I just feel like a dork. Are you sure this is the only way to do it? Is there any shortcut to doing this? Can I just get into, you know, thinking differently somehow?
Well, that's the problem. I don't believe there are shortcuts. And no. I've worked with a number of world-class athletes, world champions, and none of them have found any shortcuts. And often you'll read a book that says, you know, face Mecca or do something, you know, that's kind of shortcutty. And you may get a temporary boost for a day or a week or a month. But as you said in the introduction, you end up back where you are. So honestly, if you really want to make a permanent change, there is a little bit of hard yards to do. You don't expect to win Wimbledon without having a bit of practice, do you? And you change your life.
Really? Do I change my life by cutting out pictures from magazines of a boat I want? What does that do? Why am I doing that?
Well, that probably wouldn't change your life on its own. However, if you want to change your life, one of the things you need to have is really vivid, powerful goals that aren't just words. So as an example, you've picked on one thing there. People say, well, I'd like to buy a boat. Okay, that's a good goal, but it's kind of sterile and doesn't really do anything. But if you actually wake up and you can feel yourself on the boat, you can smell the salt water, you can imagine playing with your friends on the boat and going to an island and having a barbecue, that sort of goal becomes a lot more real and it's a lot more vibrant and it will give you more of a drive in getting things going. So that's just one tiny little tool to make your goals more real. which, you know, if you look at what champions have, they have goals that are much more vivid than most people's goals. They really feel them.
It's you might be listening to Kerry Spackman and going, yeah, pull the other one, Kerry. But interestingly enough, what he's talking about and what I'm poking him a little bit on, it was on the World Today. You might have heard it. It was back in June. There was a study of psychology students in Canada, and it was looking at affirmations versus visualizations. In other words, saying I'm lovable, which is exactly what they got them to say in the mirror. And what they found was that the people who felt okay in themselves kind of improved by telling themselves they were lovable each day, and the people who didn't feel okay, it started up an internal debate about, I'm lovable. No, you're not. You're fat. No, no, I'm lovable. No, really, look at yourself. That, and actually reduced them down. What they found was if you teach people to visualize themselves into what they called a competent mode, everyone's got their sort of buzzy expressions, but the importance of visualization was actually more, how can I describe it, more in tune with how the brain processes than just saying words over to yourself. So it's a fascinating thing. You know, your book covers a whole range of stuff, not just setting up your winner's Bible, which, as I say, I feel a bit of a dork about. But you talk about all sorts of interesting things from the point of view of your study. Let's talk about accidental hypnosis for a moment. Explain what accidental hypnosis is.
Well, it's a phrase I've sort of made up. But the easy way to explain it is, and I'm sure all your listeners will relate to this, just imagine there's a little 7-year-old girl in the playground, and we'll call her Sally. And she sees in the distance a group of what we call the cool kids. And she calls out to one of the cool kids, hey, can I come and join you in your group? And one of the cool kids yells back to Sally, nah, you can't come, you're a bit ugly. Now, at that moment, Sally was emotionally vulnerable to those cool kids. And that statement, nah, you're ugly, might have seared deep into her soul. And without her realizing it, many, many years later, she may grow up to be a beautiful young lady and actually still feel unattractive. And I know this sounds a bit crazy, but I've actually worked with a supermodel in New York where this exact thing happened. She was on the front cover of Vogue magazine. She clearly knew she was attractive because, well, she's a supermodel getting paid millions to walk up and down a catwalk, but she never felt beautiful. And so sometimes certain events in your childhood, particularly when you're emotionally vulnerable, when your emotional parts of your brain are being wired up, can have an inordinate effect on your behavior years later, often without you really realizing.
Really? Can't we Absolutely. All just think of, can't we explain our behavior retrospectively? In other words, it's not so much shaping the behavior, but I can do any behavior as an adult now and think back to a time in my childhood that will link up with it. How do we judge between accidental hypnosis and just the rough and tumble of growing up? What's the difference? What separates it out from the pack?
Well, you're right. So there's the rough and tumble of life. I think where accidental hypnosis is distinguished is when there's a huge impact on the person's behavior that doesn't match reality. It doesn't accord with reality. So clearly this supermodel, she was beautiful, there's no question about that, and she knew that logically. So when you have a mismatch between your logical understanding and your emotional feeling that is deep, that is pervasive, and that absolutely affects your behavior, then you would have to say this is not good and it's not part of the normal rough and tumble of life. Yes, we all have things and people call us names, but we tend to get over them.
So it happens when we're young. I'm looking for these identifying things. It happens when we're young. I'm cheating because I'm looking straight at your book about this. So it also happens when, according to your book, when the person who says that is someone in a position of power. So a parent, coach, peer group that we want access to, it's got to have that about it.
The other thing that's really important here is you probably remember where you were when Princess Diana died. Okay, you can probably remember that, and you can probably remember when the Twin Towers came down. You probably can't remember the day before that because it just got lost in the mists of time. And so what happens is when your brain is in what's called an emotionally aroused state, it has special chemicals released that actually burn memories deep into your brain because the brain thinks, well, these could be important things going on. And so those are called flashbulb memories, and they're very, very powerful, and your audience will probably recognize these sorts of things. Now, the same thing happens in this, what I call this accidental hypnosis. When the brain is emotionally aroused for whatever reason, either because you're vulnerable or someone above you is saying things, the brain, whether you like it or not, tends to take more notice of those things, and they tend to get laid down, whether they're important or not, whether they're correct or not. And that's what happens. And so undoing those things is an important issue. And as you've rightly said, we don't want to go back on a witch hunt looking for things that, you know, may or may not be there. You know, we live in today and we move forward. And
well, it's just I could excuse all my behavior by saying, there was that time, you know, back, I can think of it now, back. And so,
well, hopefully so most of it,
horse is what I'm talking about.
Hopefully most of it you're smart enough to say, yeah, that happened then and it's not important, I've moved on. Hopefully that's what adults do. We learn to discard most things. But I have been really surprised that as I've worked with a number of people, whether, you know, world-class athletes or business people or whatever, that a lot of people have these things left over that have an impact on them unnecessarily. I mean, you know, you take someone like Princess Diana, who we've just mentioned. Here was a woman who genuinely thought in life that people didn't like her. She genuinely thought that she wasn't attractive, and she suffered from bulimia. And yet, when she died, you've never seen such an outpouring of love and affection as happened in London, when the streets were just literally lined with flowers. So there was a mismatch between her perception of reality and reality, and that's the deep sort of thing that is important. But obviously this is just one of the tools we're talking about, and it may not apply to everything, because what's very important for me is when I work with people, there is no one size fits all.
Dr. Kerry Spackman is who you're chatting to. He's a neuroscientist, he's a motivator, he's quite a few things really. He's mathematic geek as well, but I haven't mentioned that. The Winner's Bible, Rewire Your Brain for Permanent Change, is what we're talking about. Kerry, as we look at the book, let's talk about the four pillars. I'm just jumping around things to give people a sample of, that it's more than just cut out pictures and then stare at them for a long time. What are the four pillars? We're talking about how to effectively change, I guess, and what are the four pillars in your mind for this?
Yes, well, the four pillars are the things that actually underpin your personality, and it's the most important thing when I ever work with any person. At the bottom level is your physiology. This is how your brain is wired. It's your genes. It's all those things that make up the nuts and bolts of you. And everybody has a completely unique physiology. So you the way you smell the world and the way you taste and the way you see actually is different to me, because your brain is wired differently to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to understand that. If I want to make change to you, I need to understand what's going on in there. Above your physiology is your psychology. These are all the sorts of thoughts and behaviors that you exhibit naturally. And behind that, I would have your history. These are all the events you've been through in life. Now, of course, your history affects the thoughts you have, your psychology. And as your audience will probably know, the thoughts you have can actually affect your physiology. And likewise, your physiology, if you take a few drinks of alcohol or take some drugs, it'll change your behavior, your psychology. So these things all cycle around each other.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, our psychology allows us to selectively replay our history to suit
absolutely
the light of our psychology. You know, the winners write history. So it's not it's not a third-person camera that we're staring at. It's our memory filtered through our psychology that's telling us our history.
Absolutely. So, and at the very top is your philosophy, which for me is your view of the world. Is the world fair? How does the universe operate? And so those four things all interact with each other. And sometimes just a small change in one of them will affect the other one, and we end up with a spiral round and round and round. And so you can make a small change in one of them, and it'll have a big long-term change in a person's behavior.
Is the wiring of the brain fixed? Can we rewire our thoughts? I'm using the term wiring. It's not wiring. But can we, the neurological patterns and thoughts that flicker around us, those electric impulses, can we change those? Or are they fixed and we just have to understand them?
No, well, that's the interesting thing. Recent studies have shown that the brain is very plastic, which means it can be changed, and you actually do rewire the brain. And I'll give your audience what I think is one of the most remarkable examples of rewiring your brain. If you put on a special pair of goggles that turn the world upside down, these are called inverting prisms, then you see everything upside down. You're literally paralyzed. You can't move, you can't walk, you feel nauseated, the whole world just stops. If you keep these goggles on for 2 days, your brain works out how to turn the image up the right way again, even though it's going on your eyeballs up the wrong way. Now, you think about that. That's an absolute extraordinary feat of rewiring so that you see the world the right way up, even though it's coming in the wrong way around. So if your brain can do that, I think it can change behaviors pretty easily.
Pretty easily?
Well, I mean, it does that in 2 days, and that's turning your, you know, you might have been alive for 30, 40, 50
years. Yeah, but the reason I ask pretty easily, it seems to me that we struggle changing our habits, and we can struggle over months, and, you know, you talk to other people, and they say, no, you've got to do a thing 1,000 times before you, it's not a habit. You know, I still, when I'm absent-minded, walk to the place where my microwave used to be in the kitchen before I move things around.
Depends on what it is. So some things can be rewired almost in an instant. Obviously, if you're trying to get a world-class backhand, that's probably going to take you 10,000 years of practice, 10,000 hours of practice, not 10,000 years, 10,000 hours of practice. But certainly any sort of dysfunctional behavior, if you're not making progress with it in a matter of days, then I think the answer is you're using the wrong tools. And I genuinely believe that because I've worked with a lot of people. I mean, I had one woman as an example, we'll call her Susie Q, who was addicted to methamphetamine, we call that P in New Zealand, 8 years, used it every single day for 8 years, really, really, really wanted to get off it, went to all sorts of therapy, couldn't get off it. But we did 2 sessions and she's never touched it again. Now, that says we found the right tool for her. So it's about the right tool. It's about doing the right thing. And that's the hard part, as you say. It's not often you can battle away trying to change something, but if you're doing it the wrong way, you'll never get there. It's like learning your backhand, and you've got a coach to show you how to do it.
How important are goal setting? How important is goal setting, to use better English? In other words, if I said to you, yeah, Kerry, you need to lose weight, that would be one thing. If I said to you, Kerry, you need to lose 5 kilo every 6 months, is that a more effective way? How important is goal setting and how specific should the goals be?
Well, I take quite a bit of time on goals because they're very important. First of all, your goal has to be realistic. So I can't have a goal of being the world heavyweight champion. I'm just not big enough. Hmm. So it may be a goal, but it's a stupid goal. So it's got to be realistic. Okay, that's the first thing.
I like stupid goals. But
yeah,
yes,
it's got to take account of my physiology.
Okay.
The second thing is it has to be one that is vivid, alive, and vibrant. It can't just be an empty sort of logical goal like that. That will never get you anywhere.
What's a vivid, alive, and thingy goal? What do you mean?
Well, it's a goal that you can feel, taste, touch, smell, and it's one way I can explain it is I don't know if you've ever had like a really vivid dream at night. And you've woken up in the morning, maybe it was a really bad dream and you just feel terrible the next day, or it might have been an absolutely brilliant dream and you wake up and you feel really good all day. It sort of casts a halo or a shadow over your day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have a goal that's vibrant, it has that impact on you throughout the day. And it continues to have that impact on you throughout your life.
Okay, so if I say to myself, oh, I just want things to be better, that's not a goal.
That's not going to work at all.
And if I say, oh, I just want to lose weight or I'm going to ride my bike more or whatever, they're not goals. They're just vague feelings. So do I need to be specific? Do I need to say, by week 4, I'm going to lose, I don't know, whatever. If we're
part of it is a timetable, and part of it is what is the specific actual nature of the goal, and the goal has to be realistic that we're not going to lose 4 kilos tomorrow.
Yep.
So yes, absolutely, it's got to be realistic. It's got to have a time frame, and it's got to have steps that allow you to get there. So if you want to own a 200-foot yacht, maybe you need to save up enough to own a 100-foot yacht first up. So that's kind of interesting. The next part, though, of course, it has to be so real to you that it's not just words, it permeates your soul. And it's going to be very hard for me to get that across to your audience on the radio, but I think that's something that, you know, if I look at world champions, they have a goal that is unshakable. They have a goal that even against the facts and the logic, it's still there inside them and it's still driving them forward.
Isn't that what makes them world champions though, Kerry? Don't they just think differently to you and I, and therefore not all of us are going to have such clear-cut, simplistic goals that we feel so passionate about? I often think that part of what makes people world champions is the fact that they've got a monomania, that they are I'm like the dog with the tennis ball. about that thing they want, you know, the world champion driver or the best rugby team or whatever the hell it is. Is that necessarily all of us?
No. I mean, obviously, they've got a very well-defined goal, you know, to hit the ball faster, run faster, whatever. And
sure.
So that's a very simple goal. But in answer to your question, my experience is that world champions nowadays are very well-rounded people. The idea of just being single-minded and focused doesn't work. Take Tiger Woods, for example. A well-rounded man.
You've panicked because the music's come up. It's okay. We've still got a couple of seconds. I appreciate it. Kerry Spackman is chatting to me and being poked and talking to you about change. You can read more by grabbing The Winner's Bible, Rewire Your Brain for Permanent Change. He's lolling around our Sydney studios. Kerry, thank you so much. There's been plenty
My pleasure.
Think about there.